My name is Joel Tickner from the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production at UMass Lowell, and I am the Program Director for the Chemical Science and Policy Initiative. Thank you all for being on this GC3 webinar today, which is going to discuss EPA's programs in safer alternatives.
This is Mary Louise Rainey.
Hey there. So we're just starting up the call right now.
Okay.
So we've been following and worked with EPA for about 20 years in some of its efforts in to advance safer chemicals and products, and really from our perspective, EPA's work in this area is the best in the world. Over the last several years, EPA has taken some great strides in advancing its efforts in alternatives assessments through the Design for Environment program, and more recently through the chemical action plans being proposed. And the DFE program just had a draft guidance document on defining safer alternatives. It just had the end of the comment period was yesterday. So an amazing amount of work being done, and given the changes happening in federal chemicals policy, what's happening in EPA is really helping to shape what we can be doing as a nation in terms of moving the safer area of safer alternatives forward. So our speaker today is Wendy Quillen-Hemmet, who is the director of the Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics at EPA. Wendy is the director of the office and has been there from 2009. I would ask that people put their phones on mute, please. Wendy began her career in EPA in 1979, spent her first 10 years in the agency with various jobs within OPPT as an attorney advisor, branch chief, and deputy division director. And actually, as we've been doing some work on the history of TSCA, Wendy's name happens to be all over EPA's implementation of TSCA over the last 30 years. So what I'm going to do is pass over to Wendy to lead the discussion. So Wendy will go through her presentation, and afterwards we'll have time for question and answers. There is a chat button on your screen that you can send a message with a question, but we'll have time for question and answer after Wendy's presentation. So with that, let me hand it over to you, Wendy.
Okay, thanks, Joel. I guess I'm glad you said my name was all over the TSCA implementation material as opposed to my fingerprints. I don't know. Anyway, I want to thank you and thank all the members of the group here for inviting me to come and talk to you this afternoon. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to this group. And we'll try to run quickly through this presentation to allow time for you to ask the particular questions and, you know, explore some of the areas that you all are particularly interested in. I guess we can move to slide two. Oh, no. Okay. I don't know how much background everyone on the phone has with TSCA, so I'll just do a little sort of basic overview here. And again, I can answer questions later if that would be helpful. But TSCA was enacted back in 1976. We refer to it lovingly as our disco era chemicals management statute. The idea was to create a national program that would allow EPA to gather information on new and existing chemicals, to require testing of chemicals and mixtures as we saw that was necessary, to screen chemicals and control for unreasonable risks, both in the case of chemicals that were on the market then and new chemicals that were coming on to the market, to coordinate with other federal agencies that have an interest in chemical safety, and many other provisions of the law, but those are the main provisions. It's the only major environmental statute that hasn't been reauthorized or updated since the 1970s. And it was intended to be the primary means of regulating chemicals in the country. This says industrial chemicals, but TSCA applies to essentially any chemical use of a chemical that's not otherwise regulated under the pesticides laws or as a food, drug, or cosmetic by FDA, and a few other exclusions that are essentially alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, so that it's not just industrial uses of chemicals, but consumer uses of chemicals, which I know you all are interested in, and commercial applications as well. Key elements of TSCA, one of the first things that the agency did in implementing the statute was to compile an inventory of all the chemicals that were in production at the time TSCA was passed, and that list had about 60,000 chemicals on it. Any chemical that was not on that original inventory has to go through a new chemicals review process. And another almost 25,000 chemicals have been reviewed in the new chemicals program and added to the inventory since the late 70s, so that we're now up at about 84,000 chemicals. We've reviewed about 50,000 new chemicals, but only about half of those have actually gone into production. We use some of the data gathering authorities under TSCA to collect information on production volume of existing chemicals, and some exposure and use information. That's called the inventory update rule or inventory update reporting. Most recently, we've been doing that every 5 years. We're proposing some improvements to that reporting that I'll talk about a few slides back here. And information that we collect or develop is publicly available unless confidentiality is claimed, and I'll come back to that because the provisions of TSCA actually allow for quite a bit of information to be claimed as confidential business information or trade secret or proprietary information. Next slide. When the Obama administration came in, and Lisa Jackson came in as the administrator of EPA in January of 2009, one of the first things that she did were identify her priorities for EPA, and one of her top priorities was reforming our chemicals management program at the agency. We were very happy to see that when she came in. Follow-up to that, going to the next slide, that September of 2009, Administrator Jackson made an announcement that basically focused on two paths for improving our chemicals management program at EPA. One was announcing that the Obama administration, not just EPA, but the administration, was supportive of reauthorization or reform of TSCA to improve our ability to manage chemicals. And the other is that she said that given that the legislative path was of uncertain duration and uncertain outcome, that EPA really had a responsibility to also try to implement the current version of the statute to the best of our ability to assure the safety of chemicals. So we have been working on both of those paths for the last almost a year and a half now. On the legislative front, last year we had bills introduced in both houses of Congress. Senator Lautenberg and Senate Environment and Public Works Committee introduced a bill in April, and then in July, we had a bill introduced in House Energy and Commerce. The actual bill in House Energy and Commerce was preceded by a discussion draft that was published by the committee, and there was a stakeholder dialogue that they conducted following the release of that discussion draft, where they got input from, you know, the broad spectrum of stakeholders on the legislation. EPA participated in that stakeholder dialogue and the role of providing technical assistance. And obviously the committee took what they heard into consideration and then produced a bill in July. There were a number of hearings, several hearings on the Senate side, a hearing on the House side. I don't have a slide on what's happening in the current Congress, but I can tell you what I know. Actually, Senator Lautenberg has scheduled a hearing for this Thursday, February 3rd, on TSCA reform to reiterate his and the committee's interest in continuing to pursue TSCA reform, and also hearing from EPA that the administration is still committed to TSCA reform. Steve Owens, who is the administrator, our assistant administrator for Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention will be testifying for EPA at that hearing. And then there will be a panel of people testifying on behalf of the chemical industry and non-governmental organizations and others who are interested in TSCA reform. Dr. Lynn Goldman, who's a former assistant administrator for this office, will be testifying. I think that we'll have a witness from NRDC. I think the witness list is still sort of being developed, but as well as, I'm trying to think if it's who the industry witnesses. But if you look at the SCPW website, they'll be posting information on the hearing. On the House side, obviously, we have new leadership in the House, and the path that's going to be taken on TSCA reform there, I'd say, is not clear. I think it's safe to say that the new leadership in House Energy and Commerce has some, maybe some different priorities, but I do know that a number of stakeholders that we have been talking to are telling the new leadership on the House side that TSCA reform is still a priority. The odds makers around town are saying that they think it's unlikely that we'll see legislation this year in 2011, but who knows? You know, I don't pretend to know what Congress is going to do or what's going to happen, but that seems to be the general wisdom for what it's worth. I think that most people are thinking that even if we don't see legislation in 2011, that this year provides a good opportunity for informal dialogue among the various stakeholders to explore where there might be common ground to move forward on legislation. So that's sort of what I know at this point. We're still early in, you know, in the new Congress, so we'll see what happens. On to slide 6. This is really about challenges in implementing TSCA that lead to the need for TSCA reform. As I mentioned earlier, we do have under TSCA a mandatory program to review new chemicals, but there is no mandatory program to determine the safety of existing chemicals. That is a major problem. There are difficult legal and procedural hurdles to limit or ban chemicals, existing chemicals. There are very significant hurdles even to require the generation of data on health and environmental effects to allow us to screen and assess and potentially take action on chemicals where that's warranted. And the provisions of TSCA regarding confidential business information limit access to information to the public, information, our ability to share information with other governments. We can share confidential business information with other federal agencies, but we are not allowed to share it with state or local governments or with other foreign governments where we'd like to potentially do some work sharing. So those are some significant challenges. There are a lot of other provisions of TSCA that are problematic, but those are probably the major the major issues with current TSCA. On slides 7 and 8, we have a summary of the administration principles for TSCA reform. These lay out the basic provisions that we would want to see in, that the administration would want to see in any new legislation to reform chemicals management. And these, the full version of the principles are up on the EPA website if you haven't seen them already. Essentially, they are that chemicals should be reviewed against, this is both new chemicals and existing chemicals, should be reviewed against safety standards that are based on sound science, that are risk-based, that are protective of human health and the environment. That the manufacturers should have the responsibility to provide EPA with the information that's necessary to do those reviews and make that determination. Right now, under TSCA, essentially EPA has to, the burden is on EPA to make a finding that a chemical may present a risk or does present a risk before we can, in some cases, before we can even require the generation of health or environmental effects data. risk management decisions need to take into account sensitive subpopulations, children being one obvious subpopulation that we'd be concerned about, as well as cost and availability of substitutes and There's a list of other considerations if you read the longer version of the principles. I'm going to the next page, that both manufacturers and EPA should act on, should prioritize chemicals and then review and assess those priority chemicals in a timely manner. I think that's a really important piece of this. We've learned about this in our pesticides program and other EPA programs, that it's important to be able to set priorities in a transparent way and then to move to assess priorities quickly. Of particular interest, I'm sure, to this group, that green chemistry should be encouraged, as well as providing transparency and public access to information. And finally, that EPA needs to be given a sustained source of funding for carrying this out. It's great to have authorities, but if you don't have the resources to do the work, it doesn't tend to get done. So that we would be looking for both appropriations, but also for fees that would help to fees for the industry to pay that would help to fund the implementation of any new legislation. So then on slide 9, I switch to the other path that we're taking in terms of reforming our chemicals legislation, which is trying to improve the way that we implement the current version of TSCA that we're working with. This includes a number of things. As Jill mentioned, we're undertaking some new regulatory risk management actions. We're developing chemical action plans that basically lay out a path to address some very high priority chemicals. Working on improving the information that's submitted to us by industry to help us assess, understand, and assess chemical risks, and increasing public access to information about chemicals, both by trying to improve the way that we're implementing the confidential business information regulations, as well as just making more of the information publicly available, most of that on the web. On slide 10, when Administrator Jackson announced the plans back in September 2009, she did announce the fact that we would be developing a number of chemical action plans. And when the slide comes up, it will list chemicals and categories of chemicals for which we've issued action plans. These action plans, as well as summaries of them, are all available on our website. And you can go there and see the kinds of things that we're doing. But it's basically a range of regulatory actions under TSCA, requiring testing, significant new use rules, using a provision of TSCA that hasn't been used before, which is Section 5B4, to create a list of chemicals of concern, and initiating under our DFE alternatives assessment process, safer alternatives assessments for some of these high-priority chemicals of concern.
There is quite a bit of feedback. If everybody would be willing to mute their lines, we'd appreciate it.
So I think I've sort of gone through a couple of slides here. We can probably turn to slide 12. In addition to the action plans and the various activities that we have identified in the action plans for priority chemicals, we're also moving ahead on some other important activities under TSCA. One is the improving our inventory update rule. In October, we proposed modifications to that that would move us back from every five-year reporting to every four-year reporting, lowering the threshold for reporting, lowering the thresholds for reporting on particularly on use information that will put us in a much better position to be able to prioritize chemicals and assess exposure to chemicals, tightening up some of the requirements in terms of what companies are allowed to claim as confidential business information and when they can claim it. We got numerous comments on this rule, many of them in support of the changes that we were proposing. I'm expressing concern about the changes we were proposing. The next reporting cycle will be later this year, and so we are working very hard to get the final rule in place. We are planning to have that out. We hope in April of this year to have the final rule out so that reporting can commence in June and continue for a number of months. We're, at the same time, we are moving to have all of the reporting done online, which we think will greatly speed up our ability to process the information, improve the accuracy of the information, and enable us to get the information out to the public much more quickly than we've been able to do in the past. So that aspect of it is a big improvement, too. High production volume chemicals, some of you may be familiar with the high production volume challenge that was actually initiated back in 1998 to encourage companies to submit voluntarily a base set of toxicity information on chemicals that were at that time that were manufactured at a million pounds a year or greater. There were a number of those chemicals where that were not sponsored by manufacturers where we have not received the toxicity testing, and we and the EPA committed to use TSCA authority to require that testing. So we are still in the process of getting test rules out for all of those chemicals, but we recently, we have four, basically we'll be doing four test rules to require testing for all of those chemicals. We recently finalized the second one. The third one will be finalized later this year, I think late summer, early fall, and we'll be proposing the fourth one this spring or summer. So we're moving to get that done. And then when our new inventory update reporting comes in later this year, we'll be looking at how many new high production volume chemicals we have and how we'll be following up on those. Nanoscale materials. We've had a program in our new chemicals program to look at nanoscale chemicals that are basically not based on chemicals that are on the TSCA inventory. We've had that in place for a number of years, and we've reviewed, I think at this point, several hundred nanoscale materials through the new chemicals program. We are developing rules to look at nanoscale chemicals that are based on existing chemicals. A Section 8 rule that would pull in information on existing uses of nanoscale materials, and a significant new use rule that would require reporting for new uses of existing nanoscale materials, as well as the Section 4 test rule on selected nanoscale materials. So the 8A and the SNR we hope to have proposed this spring, and the Section 4 test rule will follow on a little bit later, probably early fall. And then formaldehyde, we had been starting work on exploring using Section 6 of TSCA, which is the authority that allows us to actually restrict or ban chemicals or uses of chemicals. Congress beat us to the punch by passing legislation on formaldehyde in pressed wood products, but we have to issue, it's actually about 10 different regulatory actions to implement that formaldehyde legislation. And those regs all have to be final by January of 2013. So we're working on that and hope to have those proposed rules out by the end of this year. There is a lot of work going on in the program. Going to the next slide, 13. We are also taking a lot of actions to try to make more information that we have on chemicals available to the public. And there are a number of actions on slide 13. We have added over 500 chemicals to the public version of the TSCA inventory. There were chemical identities that had been claimed confidential in the past where we could, you know, basically go on the internet and find, you know, companies advertising these chemicals for sale and so forth. And so we made a decision to say that those confidentiality claims were no longer valid and added those chemicals to the public inventory. We've issued several new policies relating to companies were submitting health and safety data under TSCA. Section 8E being one of the primary areas, 8E is requires if companies come into the possession of data on the toxicity of chemicals that indicate that a chemical might present a substantial risk, they're required to provide that information to EPA. But we were getting submissions where that basically said, yes, this chemical presents a substantial risk, but you can't tell the public what the chemical is. We don't believe that TSCA actually allows that to happen in the vast majority of cases, and so we've issued policies to that effect and are beginning to implement those policies. We also, for the first time, have provided free access to the public version of the inventory. Before, anyone interested in that had to basically go to a third-party provider and pay for it. So we've now made that available to the public. We've made information on TSCA-regulated facilities available through EPA's EnviroFacts, where you can look at that information and combine it with other data about facilities that are subject to regulation under the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, et cetera. We have challenged the chemical industry to go back and look at their confidential business information claims, to review whether those claims are still valid. And we've gotten starting to get responses from companies on that challenge. I mentioned that we're modifying our inventory update rule to tighten up the confidential business information claims. And we recently launched a new search tool on our website, and then it was recently, just last week, I think, added to data.gov that allows people to more easily search health and safety information defined by chemical and other characteristics that allows people to more easily find information that they might be looking for. So we're very proud of this activity as well, and there's a lot more work going on there. We're revising our some of our other regulations to tighten up on CBI claims. So that's kind of a whirlwind tour through what's happening in the world of TSCA and the chemical regulation. And then we have a few more slides here on the Design for the Environment program. I know Clive and others have spoken to you before, I think, on Design for the Environment. So this may be a little bit basic. But there are two major components of the program, the alternatives assessment and the safer product recognition, both trying to help move the manufacturing processes and products closer to sustainability. Alternative assessment. Essentially here, we are trying to minimize unintended consequences. As we're moving people away from chemicals of concern, we want to make sure that what we're moving them toward are going to be, the chemicals that we're moving them toward are going to be improvements. So we look at both the chemicals of concern and the potentially safer alternatives. It's a very transparent process, which I think, you know, is good public policy, but also makes for a better technical outcome. We involve a wide spectrum of interested parties. We provide the best information that we can on hazard from both the literature and models that are available to us. The reports of the process cover process uses, life cycle concerns, alternatives, costs, and economic impacts, and helps manufacturers choose safer chemicals. It also, frankly, helps us as we're then looking at chemicals in the TSCA process to know what the alternatives are, you know, where there are issues in terms of needing to develop better alternatives. The safer, if we go to slide 16, the product labeling program, we have now over 2,100 products that meet our criteria, what we believe are very rigorous criteria. We review every ingredient in the product. We require partnership agreements and audits and re-upping of the partnership agreements. And we've also proposed some enhancements to the program relating to packaging and ingredient disclosure and communication, and particular focus on products where there's expected to be dermal contact and so forth. And we have been soliciting comments on those enhancements, I guess, and are now sort of looking at those comments and talking through how we might proceed to implement those. Going on to slide 17, unless there was something you wanted to add, Clive. Okay. We have a couple of other activities that actually were commissioned by the administrator. One is we're working across the agency with our colleagues to define EPA's role in the green products world. This is obviously a very important and issue for EPA, for other federal agencies, for all of you and your colleagues. We published a Federal Register notice and opened a public docket back in September. We've received, as you can see, quite a few comments, held a listening session that I think some of you may have participated in, also in September, and we're now going over the comments from the listening session and the comments that were submitted to the docket. To build on our experience, we'll be reporting back to the administrator on this and the deputy administrator and this spring. And then we'll, once we have that discussion with the administrator and the deputy administrator, we'll be moving forward to get back to you and other interested stakeholders on where we're going with that. She also asked us to, this office, to lead a cross-agency effort to develop recommendations on pollution prevention and sustainability in terms of how EPA broadly can more fully integrate pollution prevention approaches into our programs, how we can use information tools to better document our progress in doing that, focus our collective resources in the agency more effectively to this end, and enhance collaboration across our programs and outside of EPA. And again, she asked us to come back and talk to her this spring. And so we'll be, once we talk with her and follow up on the feedback that she has for us, we'll be getting out to the public with the results of that effort. Next slide. We have both a green chemistry program and a green engineering program in the office. We have annual Presidential Green Chemistry Challenge Awards that recognize technologies that reduce or eliminate the use or generation of hazardous substances from products and processes. Last year we had a big award ceremony. It was the 15th anniversary of the Presidential Green Chemistry Challenge. We'll be having another ceremony this year for the 16th year of the program. But over the years we've received more than 1,300 nominations. We've awarded 77 companies, universities as winners of the challenge, and the winning technology have produced results that are documented here on the slide, but in terms of reducing generation of hazardous chemicals, saving water, saving energy, saving global warming emissions, so we're very proud of this program and the activities that we think it's helped to encourage and highlight. We get a lot of press interest. I think the companies have gotten a lot of press interest when they won the Presidential Green Chemistry Challenge. So it does help to highlight the kind of work that's being done in this area. And the last slide gives you some websites where you can go to get additional information on the TSCA Chemicals Management Program, the Administration Principles for TSCA Reform, the DFE and Green Chemistry and Green Engineering Program. So there are a lot of resources there for you to draw on, as well as contact information if you're looking to get additional information from EPA. So I think we still have some time for questions.
Great. That would be great. Thank you so much, Wendy. I think Wendy's involvement in this call demonstrates the very high-level commitment of EPA to advancing safer alternatives and EPA's leadership really in moving this area of informed substitution forward. Wendy, if I could start off just asking a couple of quick sort of update-type questions. I think for people on this call, they're quite interested in sort of where in the process for the Safer Alternatives criteria document, how that will proceed, as well as the formulators project transparency document and where that's the enhancements document and how that will all proceed and the timing for that.
So for the Safer Product Labeling Program, we proposed a set of enhancements. As Joel's been saying, part of our ongoing efforts to enhance the transparency of the program, and a number of folks on the phone have been very helpful in working with us to figure out how we ought to best move this program forward to transparency. And I think we've made some huge steps, steps that we have taken already to make the program more transparent, or documenting the criteria of the program in the form of a standard. We have done a first set of enhancements through which we added audit provisions and some other clarifying provisions to our standard, and have begun to implement those. The thing that we're doing right now, this latest set of enhancements, takes a few steps that I think are really important. One of those is about ingredient disclosure or communication, and it offers folks in the industry the opportunity to go another step in showing leadership and disclosing the ingredients in the product, and frankly showing off the fact that they've got DFE products that have safer ingredients, and taking advantage of that ability to showcase what they're doing. The neat thing, I think, about the ingredient disclosure work, the ingredient communication work, is that we, EPA, took advantage of the fact that industry and NGO groups had gotten together to talk about ingredient disclosure, and had actually come up with what was originally intended to be the basis that could be used for legislation for ingredient disclosure for broad ranges of products. And we used that in the DFE program as the starting point for an ingredient disclosure program, and have gotten comments on that. The other interesting things that we've done are the requirements for dermal contact, where we've got things like hand soaps and potentially even some FDA regulated type products where we could use these enhanced requirements if we were going to recognize those types of products, but hand soaps are already a product that we recognize, and we think it's very appropriate that we have these enhanced dermal contact provisions for those. Packaging, these are enhanced requirements for packaging that a lot of our partners already meet, but that will document exactly what needs to be done, add clarity, and frankly aligns us pretty well with the side of the house that deals with solid waste and packaging provisions here at EPA. And documenting requirements for product performance. So, for the safer product labeling side, that is a summary of what we're doing right now. The most important of the changes that we're making to the program. We did get 27 sets of comments on all of those enhancements. Ingredient disclosure was the one that got the most comments. It was a very, very broad range. While folks were very careful to say that they were supportive of the program, which we greatly appreciate. There were some folks who wished we were asking for more, and there were some folks who would prefer to limit limit the scope of the ingredient disclosure. And we are in the process of figuring out where the perfect balancing point is between those comments, while maintaining the leadership position that we want to have with the program. So for alternatives assessments, a step that we're taking to enhance transparency there is documenting. Really, we're working in two areas with the alternatives assessments to make sure that we're being as transparent and as we can. And Joel, when I finish, I know you're going to want to layer a little bit of information on top here. But I'd like you to think of the alternatives assessment work in two pieces. One is methodologically, how do we work with stakeholders, how do we get the information that we need, how do we use it from a policy point of view then to inform the decision making that industry is doing, And then on the other hand, there's a more technical set of work, technical piece of work that we're doing, which is what is the toxicological criteria for human health in the environment that we are using to evaluate the chemicals, and how are we laying these out? How are we making calls? Making that as transparent as it can be. So on the first part of that, which is the methodological side, we have enhanced what's on our website that describes how we do this work. And I have to say that there were industry and NGO folks who helped us with that as we went through partnerships on flame retardants for printed circuit boards and furniture, and developing newer partnerships under to implement the action plans, parts of the action plans. The industry and NGO folks who worked with us on those partnerships helped us figure out how to do this, frankly, as did folks like Joel and a lot of folks from the GC3. So we've documented that on our website. We've written an article in ES&T that describes in detail how we handle this program methodologically. So it's out there for folks to look at. Comment on that anytime. Call us and tell us what you think we could do better. On the more technical side, the toxicological criteria, we've put that out for comment. The comment period closed yesterday. We got a number of comments in the range of probably 30 plus entities commented, and with very, very, very interesting sets of comments that range from the choices that we made for cutoffs to define high, moderate, or low concern for the range of endpoints, all the way to cautioning us on the use of endocrine effects in these alternatives assessments and encouraging expanded use. So it's you can imagine the types of comments that we've gotten. So we're going to process those comments too. We're less familiar with what they say because a lot of them came in yesterday, but we're going to be going through those and figuring out how to move forward. So thank you, Joel, for asking for that.
Fabulous, Clive. Let me. There was a question in the chat area, Clive. For the Safer Product Recognition Program, how are products selected, and do companies voluntarily submit products, or is there another process? If you could just go through that a little bit, that would be great.
Sure. So we don't actually go out and solicit for people to come into the program. It's companies who want to take a leadership position come to us. And the way that it works, the way that we make sure that we can manage the volume of products that come in, is we have two third-party profilers, we call them, folks who actually work with the companies, look at every single ingredient in the product, prepare a dossier on the environmental and human health profiles, do toxicological research on the ingredients that the company would use in those products. And then the third-party profiler and the company together make a decision about whether that information gets sent to EPA for evaluation. We do a QA check. We do structure-activity relationship work. We make sure that we put the best science that the agency has to offer to work on the chemicals in those products. So we do an evaluation of the chemicals in those products and the product as a whole. We make sure it meets our criteria. And if it meets our criteria, we will sign an agreement. My boss actually signs an agreement with somebody like the president of the company, for example, saying, this is how we will formulate the product, this is how we will use the logo, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's a audit over the period of a three-year partnership, with the potential for renewal at the end of that partnership. So that's generally the way it works. There is a fee, unfortunately, for working with our third parties that the third parties have to charge. They can't do it for free. So that's a broad overview of how it works.
Great, thanks, Clive. Let me open it up to other questions.
everybody else.
Very. Any questions from out there?
I had a question. I was interested in the slide about EPA's role in green products. And I was just curious, is EPA's goal ultimately to define a green product, to develop criteria for it? Is it sort of interested in it in more as like a safer product or a sustainable product? Or do you have any more kind of information than that you could share?
So let me take a shot and then let Wendy add. So Eve, the idea here is EPA right now has Design for the Environment and WaterSense and Energy Star. You know, those are the agency marks for sustainable products. And there are a range of others out there in the world. And some of those are from folks who develop standards that are ANSI accredited. There are others that don't use that process. There are corporate marks. There are government marks. And the question is, how does the agency feel about all of those, and how can we provide the most value to the movement that's going on out there right now? And you have the retailers who are demanding indicators of sustainability. You've got consumers whose awareness of sustainability issues and desire to participate in the growing sustainability movement. All those folks, you know, are creating this energy that, you know, EPA wants to participate in an appropriate way. And so what is the space, and what is the best role that EPA can take using taxpayers' money in that space? So I mean that's the way that I think of this and what we're trying to do right now.
Okay.
Great. Great. Clive, another question from the chat area. Is the program designed for products other than cleaning products, or are you planning to expand the scope to other types of products?
So our program is largely focused on cleaners, although that's a pretty big world of products out there. You know, there are tens of thousands of manufacturers of those products, and many, many products out there. But our approach is one that could lend itself to a broad range of wet chemical products, and even products that go beyond being just wet chemical products, where what we do, and the way that we could broaden the program, if that were a direction that we were to end up going, was we could simply look at the suite of chemicals that belong in a product. You think about an ink or something like that, or a paint. Think about the suite of types of ingredients, the functional uses that need to be satisfied to make such a product. Evaluate the range of chemicals that could be used for each of those functional uses. And evaluate them across the range of human health and environmental endpoints. It gets to be a kind of a complicated thing to do, and then figure out which are the safest, and then set criteria based on the safest set of chemicals that you could use to attain the functional use. And based on that kind of thinking, you could develop a set of criteria for a broad range of products like that. But right now, there is an issue of resources for us, and we want to be as broadly available and as responsive to the needs of folks out there as we can. But you know, we have to sort of consider the limitations that present themselves.
Great, thanks, Clive. Another question from the chat is: are you can you name the two third party profilers EPA is using?
Yeah, absolutely. So one is NSF International, who's a lot of you are probably familiar with them. They actually are a major ANSI-accredited body in the States. They set standards themselves, some for sustainability, and they have labeled water treatment devices and do a lot of non-food contact or food contact lubricants and things like that. They've got tons of programs and a robust toxicology and chemistry program, which made them very attractive to us. So NSF International is one, and that's a large concern. And then the other one is Tox Services, and that's a company that specializes in helping folks understand toxicology of chemicals that they use in products, and does some consulting work for EPA's water programs as well. They are both up on our website. If you just take a look, it's www.epa.gov/DFE, and hit the middle link, which is about safer product labeling, and there are choices under there, and one of them is how to become a partner. And under how to become a partner, there are contacts for both NSF and Tox Services.
Right. Thanks, Clive. Let me ask a question of, this is probably one for you, Wendy. When we were in the National Pollution Prevention and Toxics Advisory Committee, NPTEC, which was a federal advisory committee to advise EPA on its TSC implementation, often the issue came up of how EPA chooses the chemicals it's going to work on and then puts them in the sort of prevention hopper. So the question is, does EPA have a particular process to prioritize those chemicals that are going into the action plan arena or some kind of other action? And then secondly, how can EPA, or is EPA thinking about how to make the efforts that DFE is doing in green chemistry more thoroughly integrated throughout the agency's activities rather than sort of an add-on for particular chemicals that sort of get pushed that way?
Mm-hmm. Well, the prioritization process for the action plans, if you look in the action plans, we talk about the criteria that we use to select chemicals. So we looked at production volume, we looked at chemicals where we knew there were toxicity issues either for human health or the environment, where we thought there was significant exposure, particularly if there was use in consumer products or uses where children might be exposed. We looked for persistent bioaccumulative and toxic chemicals, and essentially, you know, kind of identified chemicals that rose to the top using those different screens for the first round of action plans. And the idea really was to be able to move out quickly with chemicals that we knew were an issue for us, were of interest generally. You know, states were taking action on quite a number of those chemicals. Other national level governments have been taking action on quite a few of those chemicals. So to be able to move out quickly on chemicals that were, you know, if I can say it this way, kind of no-brainers in terms of you know, raising risk issues for us and for others, so that we could take a closer look at them, develop additional information if we needed to, and then take action if we needed to. You know, we're looking again at those criteria and the process for sort of selecting the next round of chemicals, given that, you know, we didn't have TSCA reform last year. It looks like it's possible that we might not see TSCA reform this year. We're sort of looking again at our process for picking priority chemicals. You know, I think that the criteria that we used were good criteria, but as you know, if you're looking at a longer-term process, we want to revisit that and think about how we do it. So we're in the process of doing that right now. DFE efforts more sort of thoroughly integrated into what we do in this office as well as the rest of the agency, I think, is part of this broader effort that we talked about in terms of how do we integrate pollution prevention approaches more fully into the work that EPA does. But certainly, so that activity is going on in terms of, you know, things that the water program, the air program, the waste program are focused on. For us, we definitely want to look at moving towards safer alternatives as part of our overall chemicals program. You know, one of the things that we look at when we are evaluating existing chemicals for further work is, you know, do we know whether there are substitutes that are the cost-effective substitutes that are readily available? If there aren't, what are the barriers to that? How could we, if we don't have information on substitutes, how we develop that? And obviously the process that DFE uses is very helpful there. So we'd like to be able to expand that engagement as we look at additional existing chemicals. You know, resources are always an issue, but we're looking for ways to try to expand the application of the DFE principles.
Great, thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Quiet. Let me just ask one final question. Wendy, this is an age of the Obama administration recently ordered agencies to look at regulations and policies and their cost effectiveness, which the agencies had to do for quite a long time. How has the agency, do you believe the agency has been able to make a good case for its prevention activities like DFE, green chemistry, pollution prevention, or what kind of role can those who benefit in the marketplace from these approaches have in helping to support greater application through the agency?
Well, I do think we've been able to make a good case, and I think the fact that the administrator actually asked us to take the lead on the green products question as well as the P2 and sustainability strategy, you know, speaks well of her view of those efforts and our contribution to those efforts. The executive order that the White House recently issued really, I believe, focuses on regulatory programs, sort of reviewing regulatory programs. So our P2 programs wouldn't fall under that necessarily. But I would say, you know, as we look at how we can make our regulatory programs more effective, certainly P2 approaches and DFE-like approaches could be part of that. You know, in our new chemicals program, we've always had an effort to try to move people away from categories of chemicals that we're concerned about and towards safer chemicals, and we have a P2 recognition program within the new chemicals program. When we see people coming in with products that are improved, safer replacements for categories of chemicals where we have concerns. So we can look at doing more of those kinds of things in the context of our regulatory program.
Great. Thank you. Well, with that, let me wrap up, see if I'll ask one more time if there are any other questions people have on the call. Then we'll take this opportunity to thank you all for being on the call. The call is recorded, so it will be posted on the GC3 website. I would like to apologize once again for the technical difficulties starting up. We are actually in between two major snowstorms and all working at home, which means a challenge in getting technology working. But I'd like to thank you very much, Wendy, Clive, and others at EPA for helping to lead the call in the discussion today, and obviously for all the great work you're doing in support of green chemistry and design for environment. So thank you very much.
Sure. Well, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to do this.
Thank you. Have a good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone.